Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with a great episode for you this week, and I'm really looking forward to it. We've got some friends from other parts of the world, and I'll leave it at that for now so we can let Sam and the rest of the crew introduce people. And of course, that means I've got to pitch it over to Sam. Sam, how things out there in Colorado?
They're actually starting to warm up, Jamie. Thank goodness. It's been down to low single digits at night here, but they're promising it might go up into the 20s, so that's making me very happy. So speaking of weather, Kyle Nelson, meteorologist, what's going on here locally?
Well, locally, Sam, you know, those single digits in the overnights, I consider that great sleeping weather, but to each his own. We are actually on a little bit of a warming and drying trend after this quick hit storm system comes through during the day tomorrow to deliver a quick shot of snow to the central Rockies. After that, we sit pretty high and dry until the storm pattern picks up again into next week.
And we have Miss Becky DePodwin, our other meteorologist. What's going on the East Coast, Vic?
Well, the East Coast just went through a bit of a doozy of a storm, especially in the Carolinas and Virginia. Some parts picked up as much as a foot, which is pretty unusual for parts of Carolina and Virginia. I believe Charlotte had 4 inches of snow, which is pretty close to the record for amount of snow in December. We didn't get anything in Pennsylvania. It's just cold. Sometimes the sun comes out. One of our guests will remember what it's like in the sunless days of State College, Pennsylvania.
We'll keep the mystery going for another minute. So how are things down there in Memphis, Dr. Joe Holly?
Slightly cold, but overall not too bad.
Excellent. Well, our guests, they're coming from New Zealand, although we found out the guy with the New York accent is actually from New York and living in New Zealand. And I hope I do this right. Naba, the day... Nava, say it. I know I'm going to mess up.
Nava for dive.
There we go. Now, Nava, as we jump into this, what's the difference between you as a climate scientist and Ben as a meteorologist and forecaster?
Well, we actually work in the same team, the Forecasting Services team at New Zealand's National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research. I guess the closest equivalent would be something like NOAA or the National Weather Service. I do a bit more work in the climate change space and climate research, but we actually, me and Ben, overlap a lot. I do a lot of weather forecasting as well. We collaborate on a lot of projects, so... subtle differences, maybe. I didn't do a Bachelor of Meteorology like Ben did. I studied more climate science papers and environmental science.
Aha. Well, we were laughing with Dr. Joe a few minutes ago because we were discussing disasters in New Zealand, and he reminded us that when he went down there for a bit of a vacation in 2016, he landed right about the time there was an earthquake, and we were teasing him about disasters following him there. That must have been fun, Joe.
Well, it certainly made for, an interesting experience as far as my phone is concerned, because as soon as I turned it on upon landing, of course, it blew up with everybody wondering if I had been swept away by an earthquake. But it was on the south of New Zealand, and I was way up north and didn't even know anything had occurred, and had a great trip and enjoyed the conference there. So couldn't even tell anything had happened.
Well, hopefully you'll get back there someday. Ben, the website you sent me to called Niwa, and it says something like Te Horo Nukurangi underneath. What does that mean, actually?
Yeah, so it's actually a Maori phrase, and Maori are the indigenous people here in New Zealand. It's Niwa's tagline, and it actually means where the sky meets the sea.
I like that. Very nice. And you wrote a little article.
This is a range of research we do, I guess, everything from the weather to, we do a lot of freshwater science in the organization and oceans and things like that. So it's the interface of all the sciences.
Yeah, and jumping off what Nava said, you know, we do a lot of work in fisheries, air quality. In fact, meteorology and climate is only about 8% of the work that NIWA does. The other 92% is spread across a variety of science disciplines. And working in an organization like that, I mean, you certainly are, you have the potential to learn about different topics that you might not otherwise, be exposed to. So in that regard, it is a little bit different from, you know, a place like NOAA, whose primary focus is on weather. I would say the closest maybe branch of NOAA you might compare to our group is probably the CPC, the Climate Prediction Center. As here at NIWA, we do operate the National Climate Center, and we are recognized by the WMO as a regional climate center here in New Zealand. And we are the WMO representative for hydrology in New Zealand. So we do have quite a bit of a role in the hydro and water space, whereas Met Service New Zealand is the WMO representative for weather forecasting, watches and warnings and the like, as well as a tropical cyclone, things and of that nature.
Uh-huh. So Ben, I have to ask, Becky, of course, knew you and recommended you for this podcast, having worked with you at AccuWeather, but what made you decide to go to New Zealand?
Oh, look, I mean, it was a tough decision. I know, leaving family behind and friends, and I really enjoyed the kind of work that I did at AccuWeather as well. And, I kind of saw it as maybe a once in a lifetime kind of, opportunity to go and see the world and travel a bit and, do something that I guess a lot of maybe people wouldn't have a chance to do. So I kind of took it to the job site unseen, and I had read about the place, and obviously it's known for its natural beauty and its relatively relaxed lifestyle, certainly compared to a place like New York, as anyone from in the Northeast would know. It's busy, it's hustle bustle, and it's a bit cutthroat at times. But that's New Zealand is quite the opposite. So I think some of those things kind of were attraction points for me. Look, the rest is history. I've been here for almost 3 years, and it's quite a fun place and very, very different from the U.S. in a lot of ways, and a lot of good ways. But certainly there are things that anyone from the U.S. or Canada or wherever you're from, they would certainly miss some of those things from home, as I do, like a good old taco from Taco Bell, or
He is always disappointed with portion sizes.
Restaurants
in New Zealand.
Probably a good thing. Well, and they put up with your funny accent, huh, Ben?
Yeah, there you go.
So, I'm not one that knows a lot about New Zealand, but it's two islands, actually, right?
It is two islands. There are smaller islands as well. We have a third one right at the bottom called Stewart Island, and then dotted around are very small kind of islands as well, but two main islands, that's right.
Well, and Ben, you mentioned in your email that the clash of air masses is common in autumn and spring. Do you want to tell us a little more about how that works?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, look, most of New Zealand sits in the Roaring Forties, so this belt, in the southern hemisphere of very active weather, lots of wind. Often the jet stream pushes across, particularly the South Island, this division line from really warm air to the subtropics to the north of the country, and the lower latitudes, the Southern Ocean to the south of New Zealand, which is known for producing some of the largest waves anywhere on Earth. Many times we'll have weather systems that track up from the Southern Ocean and, get intertwined with, features in the subtropics to the north, and what makes weather? Well, it's temperature differences. So when you get a big temperature difference, like we're accustomed to seeing, or that we can see pretty frequently in those shoulder seasons like fall and in the springtime, you can get some prolific low pressure systems and some very adverse weather that can certainly produce, a share of disasters like flooding, You know, issues with water are a primary threat for us here in New Zealand. We're surrounded by water. Where, you know, we get atmospheric river events like California does or Washington and Oregon do in the wintertime. And those are, things that commonly affect us here in New Zealand.
I think additionally, we are also in the path of ex-tropical cyclones or hurricanes, as you would refer to them. So every year around this time of year, actually, we're in the season now. We're kind of watching the Pacific as well for anything forming in there as they can come down and impact us as well. And this year, I should say 2018, there were three systems that impacted New Zealand.
So just so we're clear, Nava, how are your seasons different from ours? Are they like upside down or what?
Yeah, upside down in terms of timing. And I guess depending on where you are in the States in terms of our climate would best fit in. I don't know which states you'd say, Ben, are most kind of similar to our climate. We're up in Auckland. We're in the north. It doesn't snow here in winter. It's pretty mild. It's wet. But in the South Island, some of the cities there will get snowfall. There's the Southern Alps, which run down the length of the South Island. And so they're high elevation and you get snowfall around there. But Yeah.
I mean, in terms of a comparison to the United States, it's a tough one because Auckland gets a lot of rain. We average about 43 odd inches, a little better than that, 43, 45 inches of rain in a year. We have very flat seasons in terms of temperature. I mean, we vary from about a maximum temperature on average in the middle of winter, which for clarification is June through August, of about 59 degrees. And then in the summertime, December through February, our average maximum temperature up in the lower to mid 70s. So it's a pretty flat, with very little variability. We may see freezing here, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 Celsius. Oh, man, two or three times a winter if we're lucky. So frosts are largely uncommon across the upper portion of the North Island where we live. However, at the bottom of the South Island, you're talking, 47 degrees south latitude or thereabouts, which, puts you in line with, parts of northern New England, as a point of reference for latitude. They can get quite a bit of snow down there, frosts, and some severe cold snaps as well. So, there is quite a bit of variability. We're pretty lucky here in Auckland, I'd say. We have a very agreeable climate, I would say, overall.
Well, thank you for translating the Celsius, because I, for one, am Celsius impaired, just so you know. And yeah, you made a reference, too, to the one of the biggest disasters was in 1968, called the Waihini disaster, was the most notorious. And it said it was associated with an ex-tropical cyclone. Nava, you want to explain what an ex-tropical cyclone is?
Sure. So I guess New Zealand sits a bit too far south for a true tropical cyclone to impact us. So basically, once a tropical cyclone has formed, typically they form in sea surface temperatures around 26 degrees. You need about, how many degrees? Fahrenheit, is that Ben?
They're 80 or so degrees Fahrenheit.
So you need that kind of water temperature to maintain like a hurricane or a tropical. It's the same thing. We just say tropical cyclones, different terminology. Once they start heading south over cooler water, they actually go and transition from what's called a warm core low to a cold core low. They lose a lot of these tropical characteristics and often beef out a little bit. So they become bigger low pressure systems, but maybe not as intense in the middle, but the impacts can be wider. So they're not a true tropical cyclone or hurricane in that sense, but they are still part of that, they've formed as part of that system. So we refer to them as ex-tropical cyclones, basically once they've gone through the transition and fallen apart a little bit. But just as powerful, same kind of impacts as you would expect from a hurricane. It's the winds. We've got a lot of oceans around us, so you can get really high waves, and that storm there. The Waihini disaster was associated with that, where there was a really large swell and a ferry actually ran aground, and there was about 700 people on board, and around just over 50 people lost their lives with that one. So that's a big one in New Zealand's history that people remember.
Yeah, that actually sunk, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So the chat room is sadly silent. I think they're all stunned by you.
No, actually, there's been a couple of things. There's been a couple of things in there, Sam. Let's see. It looked like Joe had a question. Joe, are you
there? Yes. Where's the mute button? That was the question. no, actually, my question was, I thought I heard them refer to the Southern Alps, and I just was like, are they really called the Alps? Is that that's actually the name of the mountain range?
That is correct. That's what they're called. I've heard that a lot of people around the world are surprised. But yes, that's what they're called. Essentially, they're formed. New Zealand actually sits it's in the Ring of Fire. So we're at the boundary of the Pacific and Australian plate, and it's a subduction zone. So where one plate's ducking underneath the other, we get the mountain ranges down the middle of the South Island. And that's what we refer to as the Southern Alps. That's what they're called. That's their official name. It's kind of why the earthquake that you experienced in Kaikoura in 2016, that was associated with that fault line as well. We get a lot of earthquakes in New Zealand in general because we are in a very tectonically active area.
Well, that certainly makes sense. And then I had one other question related to that, and that is, do earthquakes in New Zealand, are they as likely to result in tsunamis as earthquakes that we've seen in other Asia-Pacific locations?
Yeah, good question. I think if they are inland, then not as likely. A lot of the tsunamis are generated when you have an earthquake and then associated marine, like, landslide. That one in Kaikoura in 2016, there was some sediment movement associated with that, and then it generated, like, a very small earthquake nearby. But for us, I think the biggest threat in terms of tsunami would actually be earthquakes elsewhere, where you need time to kind of generate those waves. So somewhere in the Pacific, Vanuatu, for example, that kind of area, they often get earthquakes. So a threat for us is actually earthquakes elsewhere generating a tsunami and impacting us, as opposed to something locally.
Miss Becky, I'm sure you have a question or a thought, or at least want to say hi.
Hey, guys. So what are your most dangerous weather disasters over there, and how do you prepare and respond to them? This is a very kind of broad, open-ended question, but I guess similar to what happens in the U.S. with, like, hurricanes, what do you guys focus on when it comes to preparation, recovery, things like that?
Sure. I mean, I can start off. So for New Zealand in general, we have what's called the Ministry of Civil Defence and Emergency Management. So that is a kind of a government organisation. And their role, what they call the four R's, is risk reduction, readiness, response, and recovery. And they essentially they lead any national response and recovery, and they will kind of divvy out the tasks more regionally. And so they kind of lead, and then they might come to us for advice on various things. For example, that earthquake in Kaikoura, NIWA was involved after the fact, where we surveyed the sea floor and to see how things had changed, because we've done surveys beforehand. Or during a disaster, we might get asked sometimes our coastal team about any risk of flooding and things like that. But I'd say, yeah, flooding is probably one of the big ones for New Zealand. We do get these heavy rainfall events, either associated with ex-tropical cyclones or atmospheric rivers, as Ben mentioned. And just looking at our state of emergencies that have been declared over the last 2 years, and if you look at the reasoning, most of them are flooding, basically. In fact, almost all of them, other than tornadoes actually earlier in August, but we don't get the types of tornadoes like the states do. They're usually quite small here, so flooding is a really big one.
Yeah, as you can see, this is why I recruited Nava to help me out here with this interview. She's a wealth of knowledge. So tie up some loose ends. She mentioned regions. And in New Zealand, there's 16 geographical regions. Each of those regions has its own civil defense group. Those regions are probably closest in terms of relation. Maybe in the U.S., they're like counties. I would say more so than states. They're probably like counties. So each you know, county or region has basically its own you know, civil defense emergency group and relevant warnings and watches that are issued by Met Service basically help to support the readiness, response, and reaction in each of those regions to you know, a weather disaster. And as as Nava mentioned, flooding is just a real big one here. We get, I mean, lots and lots and lots of rain. Parts of the Southern Alps stick out about 12,000 feet into the sky. So as you can imagine, there's significant orographic lift or very high amounts of precipitation over mountain ranges, snow as well, once you get high enough in elevation in the wintertime. So those emergency groups in the South Island have to be prepared for several more weather hazards than in the North Island, where it's typically just rain and wind. You know, that we're concerned with, and the odd severe thunderstorm event. Again, we get oftentimes to generate severe weather here in New Zealand. We need it's a pretty stable environment overall, so we need something to really destabilize things and really you know, add some drama, if you will, to the atmosphere. And when big pieces of cold air break off from weather systems in the Southern Ocean and transfer northward during the warm season, that temperature difference that you'll see, the heating of the day and then a cold pocket aloft, is usually enough to get some hail and the isolated tornado. But look, it pales in comparison to you know, what Becky would know about in the plains and you know, in Colorado and even in the Northeast like this year.
Yeah. Well, I'm the one in Colorado. Becky's now on the East Coast. So
yeah.
I get all the fun. Ben, you mentioned the ex-tropical cyclone Fahey actually had insurance claims of like $39 million. That must have been a rough one.
Yeah, that was that happened in early February. There was three last year, Fahey, Gita, and Ola, that passed near New Zealand's borders. Typically, we only see one of those on average in a given season. But last year, it was a very interesting case. That was actually earlier this year, where we had a marine heat wave. Ocean temperatures around New Zealand were 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees above average for a prolonged period. So that was fuel for these systems as they track southward toward us. It helped to maybe maintain their structure longer than would otherwise have been the case. And it was also more moisture as well that got, you know, kind of wrung out of the atmosphere as these systems made landfall or were close to landfall here in New Zealand. And that one that you mentioned, really devastated parts of the western and upper part of the South Island. So they can certainly happen. And, you know, folks are certainly prepared this time of year, at least in the back of everyone's head. If you're traveling, you know, on a vacation to, you know, a place like Fiji, which is a couple hours, 3, 4 hours away from here, Vanuatu and New Caledonia, it's always in the back of people's minds, basically, this time of the year, as, we, you know, certainly get our share, about 10 per year, tropical cyclones in the Southwest Pacific.
Wow. So, Mr. Kyle, thoughts, questions?
Well, Sam, this is really interesting to me. I did a bit of tropical meteorology and some study of things in the Southern Hemisphere, but this is all great information. And again, huge thanks to the crew from New Zealand coming on. But what I'd like to do is really touch on and kind of integrate the climate piece of this, because we've touched on weather, which is the day-to-day, right? What happens here and now and what's forecast to happen in the short term, but more to touch on how the climate side of things is influencing the types of weather patterns or types of weather hazards that are being experienced in New Zealand. And I'm wondering if, Ben, if you could touch on that, if there's been a noticeable shift in the types or severity of weather hazards that New Zealand has experienced.
Yeah, I'll touch on it a little bit. And Nava has a you know, some really good information from a climate change perspective and kind of what we expect in the coming, you know, decade. So, you know, look, from a weather perspective, you know, the seas around New Zealand are warming. I mean, we're you know, well aligned with other places around the world, such as Australia or the UK, that have been, you know, the globe itself seeing some of its warmest temperatures on record recently. We've actually come out of our warmest summer on record, and this past January was actually bar none in New Zealand on record. So with all of this warming, it's, you know, it's warming our oceans around the country. That's dumping out more rain, more moisture. These extreme rainfall events appear to be increasing in frequency. Similarly, heat waves and that becoming more likely, and frost days, those might be declining as well. And that actually all plays a role in agriculture here. You know, we're a major wine growing. It's a major industry here. Also avocados and kiwi fruit are pretty big as well. So this whole climate thing and climate change influences that. And I'll let Nava kind of, you know, continue on and touch on more.
Sure. Yeah. I guess certainly as Ben touched upon this last summer that we had, we're just coming into our new summer season. So that was a whole year ago, but that was, we had a marine heat wave in the Tasman Sea. And that was, I guess, unprecedented. The last time that really occurred was in 1934-35, and that caused that was great for people heading to the beach and trying to enjoy the sea, but it caused havoc for our fisheries. About a fifth of the salmon and that was farmed in the top of the South Island actually died, and so we're expecting more of this type of thing to happen in the future. Extreme events, same thing, expecting those to become more common in the future, and we have already seen that, even just looking at the state of emergencies declared in the country over the last 2 years. The last 2 years are just in proportional to any other year. So it's just getting, we're already seeing some of those impacts there. Drought is another one. So I guess a little bit more of a kind of a long game, that one. But as Ben mentioned, we're a very big agricultural nation. We have a lot of farming and dairy. And so drought is not a good thing. And there was one in 2013 where actually a study looked into what role climate change played in that. And it kind of the study came out saying it extended it by several days. And current projections show us that drought or dry periods will extend in the future. So that's a real concern for some of our farmers. There are potential benefits as well. The wineries might actually say, yay, less frost, but they do still need some frost to get that bud burst, to get, I guess, the proper processes going. So, yeah, quite a few things there. I guess the other aspect is sea level rise. We are completely surrounded by the seas. We have a lot of coastal communities, and a lot of them are already impacted by erosion, particularly these big tropical cyclone events that bring big waves. If the seas are rising even just a little bit, that impacts them more. And there's been a lot of instances this year where coastal communities have been inundated, and that's a lot of insurance claims associated with these, I guess, storms around our coastal areas. And most noticeable for tourists or people that have visited the country maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if they happen to go to the southern South Island to visit those southern Alps and check out any of the glaciers, they've retreated a long way. That's something that tourists, that are repeat tourists, notice. And we're expecting those glaciers to keep declining with a warming climate, unfortunately, which is a shame because it's a real gem. Those that have tramped around some of those areas would understand what I mean.
And tramped is just another word for hike.
Hiking.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to go there. Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome.
Becky, you had some more questions.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to the weather aspect, although it's been great to hear more about the climate and everything that you guys are doing down there with regards to climate change. I'm curious, though, Ben, how does the warning system compare to the National Weather Service over here in terms of number of warnings, color coding? You probably know kind of where I'm going with this. Do you have 144 warning colors over there?
No, not quite. How many is that now?
It's two, I guess.
Five.
A warning and a watch. So there's only two categories. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no, we certainly don't have lake effect snow warnings. We don't have, you know, frost and freeze warnings. We don't have winter weather advisor, you know, so on and so forth. We only have two, and that's a watch and a warning. And basically the hazards would be described basically within. So, you know, you can have a watch for heavy rain. You can have a watch for high wind. You can have a warning for high wind. It's just those two. And then the details are kind of left to be described within the particular warnings. Met Service also issues a severe weather outlook, and that can encompass anything from thunderstorm activity to heavy rain, and that is something they issue daily that goes out 3 days. So basically it alerts, end users to potential periods of severe weather. Overall, it is a lot simpler than the U.S. system, and that is, you know, that is used by the National Weather Service right now. And I think overall that simple is probably the way to go overall. So and I know that there is some discussion about potentially going to an impact-based warning system. We're not there just yet, but in time, that may be where New Zealand heads as a nation.
Yeah, I mean, it helps that it's a much smaller country with probably fewer hazards. I mean, you mentioned counties, our counties per state compared to the regions over there. So obviously it's just scaled down so much, which I think definitely helps. With the watches and warnings, is that mostly based on the timing, as in the watch comes in advance and then the warning is as the event is closer or the onset of the event?
That's right. Yeah. Generally, they start with an outlook, and that's just very general. Yep. And then I don't know the hours exactly, but yeah, a couple of days in advance, you might issue watches based on certain thresholds. And then as you become more certain about these thresholds being met, it will become a warning. And if there is still uncertainty there, it may stay as a watch even, you know, hours or days before, or a day or hours before the event. But if there's the certainty aspect there and it's like a day before, a warning may be issued. So it's both a temporal thing and a confidence in the forecast.
It's an interesting one Nava mentions, which you would not see in the United States, and that is a weather event or a potentially severe weather event may be underway and it will still be a watch And that's just basically that there isn't enough confidence to basically for it to become a warning. There may be, you know, this adverse period of weather, and if that becomes more apparent, it will become a warning. But there's nothing that, you know, makes it become a watch or a warning from a watch. It can be a watch, then become dropped. It can be a watch, then become a warning if what is said in the watch becomes, you know, very likely or apparent that's going to happen.
Fascinating.
You could tell Becky's interest in emergency management is peeking out right there.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's actually a really interesting one because I think, you know, the nations around the globe can probably all learn from one another in a lot of ways. You know, I think there's a lot of phenomenal things that the, you know, National Weather Service does, and the amount of information and products that are available freely on their website and you know, other parts of NOAA generally is, you know, among the best in the world. So certainly they are, you know, world leaders, but look, we can all do better. We can all improve. And, you know, I think we can all kind of use bits and pieces from different organizations to, you know, come up with maybe the best way of doing things, you know?
I think the watch and warning system here is interesting because although it's maybe simpler to what's done in the States, there has still been significant failures in, because it's not impact-based, it's still based on these meteorological thresholds of wind. These are in kilometers per hour, say 110 for, say, high winds. To the general public, that might not mean anything, or they don't really understand what that means. And so sometimes, although there may be official watches or warnings out, the message is not necessarily there to the public. It depends how it's picked up by the media and what spin they put on it. And therefore, I think places like the UK Met Office, who have moved to an impact-based system where they are looking at not just the thresholds for the meteorological conditions, but where they are, the timing. So is it going to impact a commute or a very heavy populated area? And they actually adjust the level of warning based on those type of more societal things. I think that's probably a better way to go than what's being done here. And that's where I think New Zealand is trying to get to as well, but that hasn't been implemented yet.
Well, we have a Facebook group, which has got a pretty strong presence, and we have a lot of international folks in there. And we've actually been pulling some of them into the podcast so we can learn about, you know, different emergency management systems across the world. And so we find that piece of it pretty fascinating, too. So, Jamie, we finally got around to you again. thoughts or questions on your...
You know, actually, I had a question, and I'm hoping Ben and Nava together can answer this. Ben, with your experience here in the United States and now being down in New Zealand, I'm curious, we talk a lot on the show about community resiliency and the impact that has on disaster preparedness and response during an event. What's the culture of resiliency in the midst of, you know, the common person, the average guy on the street or family? Is preparedness something that people are more aware of there, or is it pretty much the same, you think, as we have here in the States, where a lot of times, you know, people don't even pay attention to the warnings? I know Nava made a comment about, you know, sometimes people don't necessarily heed what the weather's and climate experts are saying to them, but I'm curious if that's different or the same to the States.
I think it probably depends where in the country you are and what kind of your profession is. In terms of weather, I think our farming communities are certainly more on top of the game there. They're really tuned to the weather and they are quite prepared just because they are so impacted by quite a lot of different ranges of weather. New Zealand as a whole, I'd say places like Wellington, which is our capital, because they experience earthquakes quite a lot, they're probably prepared in that sense. So a lot of them might have emergency kits or things because there is a high risk of earthquakes. They know what to do, how to drop down and cover and things like that. So parts of the country that are impacted by earthquakes, I think they're ready for that. But weather, maybe not so much. It's almost back of the mind. I mean, luckily now we get a couple days warning, so it allows people to make plans, unlike an earthquake where you just have to react instantly. So I'd say it's quite variable around the country and depending on the disaster as well.
Yeah, I think, yeah, leapfrogging up what Nava said, I mean, compared to the U.S., look, man, you're going to see a lot of different things kind of where you are, depending on where you are in the country. I mean, you know, people hear things like 100-kilometer wind gusts, you know, 62-odd miles per hour, and they're like, oh, so what? You know, they'll kind of just pass it, you know, pass it, let it pass by. But if you say, you know, there's going to be a period of, you know, intense winds tonight that could, you know, could damage and cause power outages, then, you know, maybe that'll resonate with people a little bit more. So it's all about communication. And that is not only the challenge here in New Zealand, but, you know, look, it's the U.S. as well. You know, I think of just a few weeks ago with that snow event that affected New York City. That's a prime example of where, yeah, maybe the communication aspect, you know, obviously there were some balls dropped, you know, by various parties within that. And it's kind of that communication challenge that I think we're all kind of battling together. So in that regard, look, it is similar in a lot of ways.
I think a lot of false alarms, make people complacent as well. Over a period of years in New Zealand, we had a lot of tsunami threat or alarms, so a lot of challenges. And people just got so sick of them. We had these tsunami warnings issued, nothing would eventuate. And so it got to the point where people would kind of head to the beach and not really listen to them. So it's that kind of boy cry wolf scenario where if you say it too much and nothing eventuates, nobody does anything. So I think that's been kind of reviewed and managed. We certainly don't get a lot of, I think the tsunami warnings are a bit better managed now. But yeah, there's always a risk of that happening too.
Wow. I have one question, too. Dr. Joe's a part of USAR, which you're probably familiar with, Ben. Do they have any kind of urban search and rescue in New Zealand?
I believe so. So we in 2011, we had quite a major earthquake in Christchurch, which toppled a lot of buildings and a lot of people trapped in that. So I believe there were some people brought in, maybe even from overseas, because I think our equivalent to USAR is quite small. It definitely exists, but I'm not sure how, because it's not very common that they're needed, I'm not sure how big the team is. So for a major disaster, often people from the likes of Australia actually get sent in. It's about a 3-hour flight. So, yeah, we lean on help from overseas during any major disasters.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Joe would love to go back there sometime. Would you, Joe? When there's no earthquakes?
absolutely. Absolutely love my trip there. And as we've already heard, the country is beautiful and so are the people. So it's absolutely a wonderful place to visit. I'm sure it's even better to live there.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, right now, I know this is kind of the back of the show, but you guys kind of went around the table and did some weather reporting, and I can confirm that it's partly sunny and 73 degrees here in Auckland right now, and parts of the country are expecting temperatures near 90 early next week. So we're well and truly into the summer season here in New Zealand.
Well, it's about 3 in the afternoon there, isn't it? Or 2:45 or something.
That's right, 2:45.
So, Kyle, any more?
The question we get over here is, what time is it?
Kyle, any thoughts from you?
Well, final thoughts from me, Sam. It's really neat to see some of the parallels as well as the uniqueness between how we kind of operate things here in the U.S. with regard to communication, forecasting, and alerting, and how that may differ from our counterparts in New Zealand. And so I think it's been a great podcast and really opened my eyes as well to just another way that countries around the world can take the same information and the same kind of ideas and integrate that in a different way. And I'm excited to learn more going forward. Huge, huge thanks to you guys for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us. Very interesting and great to talk with some folks from the homeland.
It's been my pleasure.
We're still here. So, Becky, final thoughts?
I just really appreciate you guys coming on. I have really been fascinated with the direction that the show has gone and learning more about international weather and emergency response. So I know we asked a lot of comparison questions, but it helps to have kind of that base point. So Ben, I appreciate you coming on because you really were able to provide that comparison to the U.S. and help us get a baseline for what goes on in other countries compared to the U.S. And I that's really helpful because, like you said, we can learn and improve and become better by working with one another across borders.
Yeah, totally agree. And appreciate the opportunity.
Well, and I agree too. And it's nice to have this communication link established. So if something big did happen down there, we could get a hold of right information. So that's always a good thing.
Absolutely. It is our tropical cyclone season. So you never know.
Well, we'll be watching. We'll be paying a lot more attention to New Zealand now. So, Jamie, going to throw it back to you.
Well, I'm really enjoying this episode, and I too agree with Becky that I'm enjoying the international flavor of trying to really get a sense of what other communities and nations around the world are doing with their disaster response systems, whether it be weather-related or otherwise. And so I really appreciate having folks come on. I throw it out there to the rest of the community. If you're listening to this show and you're in another country and you're associated with response, whether you'd like to come on or you'd like to recommend us contacting someone you know to come on, we'd love to have them on and talk about how your system works and what's the same and what's different from what you've been hearing us talk about here on the show. I think, as Kyle pointed out, we can learn a lot from what we do differently and what we do the same and kind of get a different look of how people are doing things. So that's really great. And it comes back to training in so many ways. I mean, different systems, the question about USAR teams and things like that. Joe, how often do you get requests? I know you've been overseas a couple of times to different countries doing training with Paragon Medical Education Group to talk to other systems about what's going on and what kind of work you do.
I absolutely love doing that because I learned so much from the way other services have done that. And I actually will be lucky enough in January to be in London, England, and early in March to be in Bangkok, Thailand. So very excited about those two things coming up. But no matter where you are in the world, we would absolutely love to talk to folks. And you can always find us at www.paragonmedicalgroup.com. Or on Paragon Medical Group's Facebook page, or through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
And thank you again for your continued support of the show. And again, I have to say this all the time, folks, but the customizable experience that Joe and the rest of the team put together is second to none. And so whatever your system needs, large or small, they can probably put something together for you. And all you need to do is just call and have a little chat with them so they can tell you exactly how they can bring an amazing educational and training experience to your system. So thanks again, Joe. Appreciate it. So I'll go around the table here and kind of find out how we can get in touch with folks. Ben and Nava, we usually ask folks if they have like a Twitter handle or something that people can follow them on. I don't know if you guys have that and like to share, but feel free to do so at this time.
Yeah, we certainly do. You can reach us at NIWA Weather. That's NIWA Weather.
Yep, we're on Twitter and Facebook at that same place. So that is the kind of the weather and climate arm of NIWA. The main NIWA account is NIWA underscore NZ, or in New Zealand speak, NIWA underscore NZ. I'm personally on Twitter at Ben Noel Weather, but don't necessarily follow me if you want New Zealand weather, because I tweet most stuff about the U.S. as it's my outlet to weather forecasts back home.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate you coming on in the middle of your day and making squaring away time in your schedules to be on the show. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us. And enjoy the rest of winter there.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's been fun.
Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. Feel free to follow along on Twitter and Instagram or connect with me on LinkedIn.
Becky, how about you?
I am also on Twitter at WX underscore Bex. I'm in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, and I just have to give a quick shout out to the ridiculously gorgeous picture that Kyle just posted on Twitter of Buttermilk Mountain.
Yeah, Kyle has some good stuff, so definitely follow him on his Twitter feed. You'll get some good stuff and great information from both Kyle and Becky regarding weather and all sorts of other things. So please keep in touch with what they're doing. It's great. Dr. Joe, we already found out about where Paragon is and what you guys are doing, but thanks so much for being part of the show. I know we didn't really cover a lot of medical stuff tonight, but I think it was a good episode.
Oh, it was amazing, and it's always great to talk to folks from, you know, other systems, and especially from New Zealand, one of my favorite places in the world. So thank you guys so much for coming on, and we enjoyed having you.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, as Joe said, on our Disaster Podcast Facebook group, and I'm going to try to coerce Ben and Nava into coming over there so we have more of an international presence. Otherwise, on social media under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic, and I'd hope you'd check me out on Facebook, Twitter, or other places, friend or follow me. It's always great to get in touch with folks from the community here at the Disaster Podcast, and always over at our Facebook group, where we will put this episode and all our episodes up and have discussions in between on a variety of topics. And I encourage all of you to feel free to share links, articles, ask questions, whatever the case may be, in that Facebook group. That's what it's there for. And you can answer each other's questions, and as well as we will do the same. It's important for us to share for the community what we have in our own bucket as far as experiences and specialties. So let's keep doing that. We've had a lot of great discussions recently over there, and I'm looking forward to some more. Sam, good talk tonight, and good flavor of what other people in other parts of the world are doing to manage disaster and climate response.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I'm hoping we'll hear from more of our international folks. Maybe we can get somebody, one of our Australian friends, to come up and offer their mind. But I'm trying to think of a good tagline for this show. I guess I could say, international weather is not our everyday weather.